Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
I met a lot of millionaires, you know, because there's a lot of millionaires in rock and roll, and the more money they got, the more miserable they are.
Lemmy was ugly, broke for half his life, and smelled like smoke and whiskey. And that's why people loved him.
Thank you, everybody.
I think Lemmy is the epitome of rock and roll.
He clawed his way out of English pubs and piss-soaked flats with nothing but a bass, a throat full of gravel, and a stubborn commitment to live life on his own insane terms.
So I've always kind of looked up to Lemmy in terms of the great kind of figurehead of the rock and roll world.
He is proof that outcasts sometimes win, not because they change, but because they double down on being exactly who they are. This is the legendary story of Lemmy. Born Ian Fraser Kilmister on Christmas Eve in 1945 in England in a town named Stoke-on-Trent, Lemmy's legend began humbly. His father left before he was old enough to remember him, so he was raised by his mother.
I was raised good. My mother was a smart woman, and she was intelligent, and she was, like, straight, you know. I didn't yearn for my father, you know, to take me fucking hunting, you know, like, I didn't miss the comradely grasp of the grizzled chin, you know, who cares, you know, I was doing all right. I just never missed a father because I never had one, you know, so I didn't care. I mean, my mother had a couple of boyfriends, you know, when I was a little kid, but like, uncle this and uncle that, you know, they never lasted long.
At the age of 10, Lemmy and his mother moved to a farm in North Wales. At school, he stuck out like a sore thumb, one English kid surrounded by 700 Welsh. They didn't like him, didn't want him, and they made damn sure he knew it. That sense of being on the edge of things, never quite fitting in, wasn't just a childhood memory, it became part of who he was. As a teenager in the late 50s and early 60s, Lemmy found the two things that would shape his life: rock and roll and women. He grew up in a holiday resort town where summers brought waves of tourists and plenty of girls for him to chase.
Yeah, well, we used to get all these chicks came down to, because I lived in a holiday resort, so you'd get different girls would come down certain weeks, so you'd plan your summer ahead, you know.
Lemmy chased girls and music records with equal zeal.
What were the most important records to you in forming who you are, your own voice?
I don't know. Little Richard, obviously. The MC5. Jerry Lewis. Some Elvis, but be picky. Eddie Cochran. There was a lot of really good singers back then, you know, and it was like the punk thing. They were here and gone in 2 years.
As a teenager, Lemmy got his first guitar and started teaching himself by copying records.
I just heard rock and roll and that was it. That was the end of seeking for a right job, you know. That was it, you know.
At 16, he even saw the Beatles at the Cavern Club in Liverpool, an experience that changed his life forever.
And I saw the Beatles about three times up there, I think. And then I saw them again in Flanders and Odeon when they got big, you know. They were excellent, yeah. I mean, later on you couldn't tell what they were doing because of the screams, you know, like, they were really a good band at the Cavern, they were great, you know. Eating sausage rolls in between songs, singing with your mouth full, you know.
The Beatles were loud, wild, and sexy, and Lemmy liked that.
The Beatles changed the world, you know. They really did.
He would later say he preferred the Beatles to the Rolling Stones, and that John Lennon was the true rebel rock star.
And this guy was surrounded by all these chicks. And I thought, that's the job for me, you know what I mean? All them girls.
Well, he was always the asshole of the band, you know, like, he was always the one that was really unpopular with everybody outside the band, because he would undermine them, you know. He was good at that. And people had missed his books, because if you read his books, he's not the peace-loving, nice guy that you heard about, you know.
By the mid-60s, Lemmy was playing guitar in local bands. In 1965, he landed in a Blackpool group called the Rockin' Vickers, almost by chance. One night, their guitarist stormed out after a fight, and Lemmy, who had been hanging around as a kind of manager, grabbed a guitar and filled in.
And this particular night, we had a big argument at the Top 20 Club at Failsworth near Manchester, and off they went. And Lemmy says, I'll do it. And we went, get out of it, Lemmy. He went, no, come on. And he got on stage, and I'll tell you what, you wouldn't have known any. He made the sound of two guitars, a lead guitar and a rhythm guitar. And he never stopped after that. You couldn't believe what he churned out of them amplifiers.
There he was, a young bloke with a Beatle haircut and a guitar, getting his first real taste of popularity.
We decided that we'd have a three lineup at the front and the bass player at the back. Lemmy was so popular, he went to the front. I went in the middle, vocalist. Siggy with his drums went to the left-hand side. In the mid-60s, it was different. People weren't used to that. So you got three personalities at the front vying for the attention of the girls in the audience. So the three to go at, and we were crazy.
The Rockin' Vickers never made it big, but they did cut a few singles and tour across the UK and Europe. For Lemmy, it was the perfect training ground for the rock and roll life that lay ahead.
Well, we got in the charts with one single, Dandy, Ray Davies' song from the Kinks. That got to about number 34, I think, or something like that, in the charts.
In 1967, Lemmy moved to London, right as the psychedelic scene was exploding. The city offered everything, music, drugs, and endless opportunities. He briefly joined a psychedelic band, playing guitar and even singing on one album. But the real break came by chance. He became a roadie for Jimi Hendrix. Lemmy had befriended a guy who helped Hendrix with his gear on the road and ended up essentially squatting in his apartment. So whenever this guy needed an extra pair of hands, Lemmy was right there.
You were part of the crew at the time then?
Well, there's only two of us.
Right. What were you doing?
Seems ridiculous now. There's only two of us doing all Hendrix's stuff. All Hendrix's stuff, two of us.
He tuned Jimmy's guitars, hauled his amps, and picked up the pieces of Hendrix's smashed effects pedals after shows. In the process, Lemmy got a master class in rock and roll mayhem, but also got introduced to LSD.
I was Jimi Hendrix's roadie. What do you expect? You know, I mean, he'd come back from America with 100,000 tabs of acid, right?
Who, Jimmy had?
Yeah, it wasn't even illegal then. He brought it back in his suitcase. And he gave half of it around the crew. I mean, that's a lot of acid.
And what were you were part of the crew?
Being a roadie for Hendrix didn't exactly pay the bills, but it gave Lemmy something better, a front row education in how to become a fucking rock star. By the late 60s, Lemmy had floated through different bands and racked up a lifetime's worth of stories, but he still hadn't made a name for himself. The turning point came with Hawkwind, a band at the center of Britain's experimental space rock movement. Meeting them would launch Lemmy into the next phase of his life. In 1971, Lemmy joined the London-based psychedelic space rock band Hawkwind as their bassist, despite the small detail that he never actually played bass before that. True to form, Lemmy just plugged in and went for it.
And then I showed up to go for the guitar player job with Hawkwind, and we found out they weren't going to get another guitarist. They were going to carry on with the Dave Brock playing lead, but the bass player never showed up because it was a free gig. And he left his guitar in the gear van. Can you imagine how dumb that is? You know, so it's like steal my gig, so steal his gig, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. On his bass, you know. Just about an insult to injury. That was the first time I ever played a bass. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Adapting his guitar chops to the bass, he developed a unique style, cranking out distorted chords and rumbling riffs, rather than traditional bass lines. It was unorthodox, but it gave Hawkwind's trippy music a dangerous, propulsive edge.
Yeah, it was quite an education, because, I mean, bass was easy for me, you know. That was where I was supposed to be. I was supposed to play bass, you know.
Lemmy could more than hold his own in a band notorious for its chemical intake. Hawkwind's members were serious acid heads, living in a perpetual haze of LSD and psychedelic drugs.
Yeah, it was a lot of acid. Believe me, it was a lot of acid. Because, you know, they say it doesn't work 2 days in a row. We found out if you double the dose, it does. So.
Then came 1972. Lemmy hijacked the mic for Silver Machine, a song that shouldn't have worked, but somehow clawed its way to the top of the charts. Overnight, they weren't just a cult act. They were packing halls across Britain. The gigs looked like an alien invasion, lights melting your pupils, smoke choking the air, and Lemmy's bass rattling your teeth. But let's be real, everyone in that band was high out of their skulls. However, while Hawkwind's cosmic weirdos loved acid, the drug that turned concerts into kaleidoscope space missions, Lemmy eventually started grinding his teeth on speed. So, the rest of the band eventually started complaining that he was bringing bad vibes because while they floated through hallucinations, he was buzzing like he was plugged into an electric socket, ready to fight and drink all night.
I was the last speed freak, see, I was the one that kept them all awake nights, you know, and shit like that, so they were all like dedicated dope smokers and taking acid, man, and, you know, all that. And I was taking acid too, but I was a speed freak as well, you know. And Dipmick was a speed freak. He got me into the band so he could have somebody to chum out with, you know. And then he left and I was the only one left. So they were dying to get rid of me, really, ever since he left, you know.
The breaking point came in May 1975. As Hawkwind crossed into Canada for a gig, customs officials stopped them, ripped through Lemmy's stuff, and found white powder. They thought it was coke and tossed him in jail. He spent the night in jail, only for the charges to be dropped when the lab revealed the substance was actually speed and not cocaine, as he had been originally accused of. Ironically, this technicality saved him from prosecution. But Hawkwind had enough of him. They fired him on the spot. To him, it was pure hypocrisy. If he'd been caught with acid, the band would have treated him like a victim. Instead, they tossed him aside.
When you started Motörhead, that was after you was kicked out of Hawkwind because of drugs.
Well, because of the wrong kind of drugs.
Yeah.
They were all taking drugs too, it was just different drugs, you know.
Lemmy came home to England furious and inspired. He wanted a band that was fast, filthy, and dangerous. His first name idea said it all, Bastard. But his manager thought it was career suicide.
So were you kind of clear-eyed about the band's commercial prospects from the start, or?
Well, no, I wanted to call it Bastard. And then our manager pointed out that we probably wouldn't get a lot of TV, you know?
So Lemmy twisted the blade and came up with Motörhead, street slang for a speed addict. Also, it was the title of the last song he'd written for Hawkwind. Motörhead's first lineup featured guitarist Larry Wallace of the Pink Fairies and drummer Lucas Fox. They were a messy trio and the early days were rough. Crowds in London didn't know whether to cheer, boo them, or cover their ears.
If it's a great audience, it's better, you know, obviously. But if it's a bad audience, we keep playing till they like it, you know.
By the end of 1975, Motorhead were crowned the best worst band in the world.
No, I don't know. We were just not a very good band, you know.
Most bands would have been humiliated, but Lemmy pushed through.
We won a contest in one of the music papers. We were the best worst band in the world. There's a category all for us, all by ourselves. And that killed our career for about 2 years. You know, we almost broke up.
If Motorhead was too loud, too sloppy, too much, that meant they were doing it right.
You know, which was great, you know. That's how it should be. If your dad says, turn that shit down.
The holidays are here, and that means it's the most wonderful time of the year to save with Rakuten. Use Rakuten to stack cash back at your favorite stores on top of holiday sales. That's savings on savings. With Rakuten, you can get cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. From toys for the kids, to kitchen gear for the person who loves to cook, to electronics for everyone. You can even save on something for yourself. Just shop the stores you love, and cash back is automatically added to your account. And you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. It's truly a no-brainer. Join for free today and get a new member bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.
Extra value meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
You're doing it right.
Motorhead's first shot at an album in 1976 was a disaster.
Have you written any songs directly as a consequence of doing drugs?
Oh, all of them.
The record was so bad that their label refused to release it, dropped them, and both Wallace and Fox left the band. But once again, Lemmy didn't give up. So he went hunting for new bandmates and came back with guitarist Eddie Clark and drummer Phil Taylor. Two maniacs as reckless as he was. That's when Motorhead stopped being a mess and started being a weapon. In early 1977, they recorded their self-titled debut, Motorhead. The sessions lasted just 2 days, fueled by desperation and amphetamines. The album saw release on a new label, cracking the UK top 50. But more important than the charts, it nailed Motorhead's identity. Punk speed, metal volume, and Lemmy's rasp. Seeing Motorhead live was like standing in front of a jet engine. Deafening volume, zero polish, and pure chaos. They were too violent for punk, but also too filthy for metal. But that's why both sides love them. Motorhead didn't just bridge the gap, they bulldozed it.
Well, the thing is the funny thing about, like, I felt about Motorhead is that you guys really brought the bridge between punkers and people that were so-called heavy metalers.
Well, it wasn't really a bridge. It was just that there were odd ones that they accepted, you know, and we were one of them.
Motorhead formed back in 1975 during the middle of the punk rock explosion in England. I asked bass player and group founder Lemmy if there was a problem being a heavy metal band in the punk era.
No, we got accepted by the punk thing completely. I don't know. Well, I suppose it was because our music was the same sort of pace and the same sort of ferocity as they were, you know.
Because we talk to anybody.
Yeah, right, it's because we don't mind who we talk to. It was easy, you know. We used to do gigs, they'd do the adverts and then Motorhead and then the Damned, you know. And we got the odd bottle, that was about all. But the adverts got more bottles than we did, so that was all right, you know.
This one's called, with our usual talent for picking nice, homely titles, Shoot You in the Back.
By 1979, Motorhead had broken through to the mainstream of British rock without softening their sound. That year saw the release of Overkill and Bomber, two back-to-back albums that established their authority. The title track of Overkill introduced double-kick drumming like machine gun fire, something pretty much unheard of at the time, and that would become foundational for thrash and speed metal years later. The band was evolving. They sounded tighter, faster, and possibly more aggressive. Lemmy stood at the center, mic tilted down so he sang upward, head back, bass slung low. With hair flying, he embodied raw rock rebellion, spitting songs of gambling, war, and life on the road. By the end of 1980, Motorhead dropped an atomic bomb, Ace of Spades. At just under 3 minutes, it condensed the band's entire ethos into one track. Gambling imagery, relentless speed, and one of the most recognizable bass riffs ever recorded. It wasn't crafted to fit radio, yet it still climbed to number 15 on the UK singles chart. For a band long considered outsiders, Ace of Spades made them impossible to ignore. The Ace of Spades album that followed became Motorhead's defining masterpiece. Pure speed, pure filth, and zero apologies. Critics who once laughed at them suddenly had to choke down the truth. This band had cracked something primal.
You've adopted the Ace of Spades as your motif. Why the Ace of Spades?
Because it's bad luck. Ace of Spades is bad luck, isn't it? See? So we figured if we use bad luck as our theme, then it can't get any worse.
In 1981, Motorhead dropped No Sleep Till Hammersmith, a live album so brutal and ear-splitting it felt almost dangerous to listen to. And it still debuted at number one in the UK. I mean, to put this in context, we're talking about a Motorhead live album. Something as raw, as ugly, and as unpolished as it gets, sitting on top of the charts. Motorhead's rise brought excess, and Lemmy embodied it fully. With larger venues and bigger earnings came more alcohol, more drugs, and less sleep. Yet somehow, Lemmy stayed professional, rarely missing a show, always delivering and usually remembering most of the lyrics.
You were either straight or you were rock and roll. You know, there's only two things then. There wasn't all these degrees of rock and roll.
By the early 80s, Motorhead were on top of the rock heap in the UK and Europe. They even made inroads in the United States, where their Iron Fist tour rolled through in 1982 to a growing cult following. Lemmy had finally hit the jackpot. Money was rolling in, though he later admitted he lost most of it, and Motorhead were suddenly national darlings. But the higher you climb, the nastier the fall. The Ace of Spades rush didn't last, and soon Motorhead were about to slam headfirst into reality. Rock history is littered with band breakups, and Motorhead wasn't immune. In 1982, guitarist Eddie Clarke stormed off Mid-American Tour because Lemmy wanted to record a cover of Stand By Me. Eddie thought it was a sellout move and bailed. And just like that, Lemmy lost his right-hand man at the height of Motorhead's rise. But instead of crying about it, he replaced him with Brian Robertson. Together, they put out Another Perfect Day. Not a bad album, but not as good as their previous work. Plus, when they took it on tour, fans were pissed that Eddie had left the band and didn't like the new guitarist. Meanwhile, drummers rotated. Phil Taylor took a break, then Pete Gill stepped in, then he left, and then eventually Taylor returned. And in 1986, Motorhead came back swinging with Orgasmatron, an album that slammed religion, politics, and war. A year later, rock and roll hit shelves, but by then, the world around them had changed faster than they could adapt. Metal itself had changed too. Thrash bands like Metallica, Megadeth, and Slayer, bands who had borrowed directly from Motorhead,